I will call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Fisher, would you, have you looked at the minutes from February 8th?
Yes, I have, sir. I'd like to move their approval.
Representative Fisher moves the minutes for February 8th, 2023. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members and audience, we have a very full agenda today, so we are going to try to move promptly. We've assigned about 15 minutes for the first bill, and that is House File 1423, Representative Kozlowski, elk reintroduction funding provided and money appropriated. Welcome. I will move that House File 1423 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Kozlowski, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and members of the committee. Welcome. Can I just start with my statement?
Is that okay? There's nothing in there. It's mine.
Welcome. Proceed.
Right. Buju Bizendawayeg, Hozawa Anakwad, Alicia Kozlowski, Jagamashimo, Magazine and Dodam, Gichi Onagaming, Masabi Kong and Dunjaba, Miguchi Wendam, Omash Kuj. Glad to be here. I hail from Grand Portage, but am a descendant of Fond du Lac, and so very proud to be here alongside our tribal nation here to talk about our elk restoration bill. So I want to just say thank you for the opportunity to present HF 1423, a grant to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, which will restore elk to the Cloquet Valley once again. Most of the land in this area is in public ownership already, and large farms and row crops don't dominate the landscape as they do in northwest Minnesota. Elk would also be moved over a period of 3 to 5 years with this bill, with the ultimate goal of restoring once again the abundant native species to a suitable habitat on and near its historic range in northeast Minnesota, as well as establishing a robust self-sustaining herd with opportunities for elk viewing and future hunting by both tribal and non-tribal members. Elk would be required to undergo appropriate health screenings before release, and this project will be done in close cooperation with the Minnesota DNR and other public and private partners. And lastly, I'd just like to thank my co-sponsors and Chair Hansen, Representative Keeler, Chair Becker Finn, and Lead Heitzman on this bill. Today I also am joined by Chairman Kevin Dupuy from the Fond du Lac Band to provide additional testimony and answer any questions that you may have.
Great. Chairman Dupuy, welcome.
Bonjour, bonjour, Chair and members. Nagani Moose Indigenous Cause, Nagachawananga Nujabama Gizi Doliam. Hello, my name is Kevin Dupuy. I'm the chairman from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I think the most important thing is Omash Kuj is what we call elk, and it resided in this region all the way from the western part of the United States to the eastern seaboard in the northern regions of the United States. It is a very cultural significant piece or animal to the Ojibwe or the Anishinaabe, with others also. But at the turn of the encroachment and movement, when people started moving from the east to the west, the elk were definitely a large populated animal with inside of the region that we are here today, and got to the point where it's almost extinct, just like woodland buffalo. But as of right now, the important reason that we want to reintroduce the elk to that region is not just for the Anishinaabe people, but to everybody to have a piece of this and everybody to be part of an animal, another majestic animal like the moose that we have in northern Minnesota, that the people have the ability to enjoy it, hunt it. You guys call it sportsmanship, but we don't use that term in our language. It's a point of feeding ourselves. But within that, everybody has the right to feed themselves. So we look at it as an equal principle of why we want the elk back into the region, so everybody has the ability to enjoy this this great tasting meat. But again, our important piece of it is go back to the way our way of life and our culture and how we are tied to the animal itself. So Miigwech, any questions?
I think we're going to take one more the other testifier, and then we'll take questions for both testifiers. So Mr. Bronson, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ryan Bronson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has 19 chapters here in Minnesota. We have worked in on habitat projects about 80,000 acres here in the state. We support elk expansion in places where they're wanted. We're involved in the research on this project to do the habitat suitability work and also the public support suitability work. We think that this is a worthy project and we support it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Okay, we'll open up for questions. Representative Liz Lagarde.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I see that there's is it 4 million?
Representative Kozlowski.
Yes, that's correct, Representative Liz Lagarde.
Representative Liz Lagarde.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the DNR going to have any access to this? Would be question. I'll just ask a couple questions. And then, you know, obviously we've learned a lot in the last 2 or 3 weeks about diseases that are, you know, going amongst animals. What is the plan about to make sure that as we're transporting that none of these animals are going to come this way and it's going to spread from species to species? And is there going to be a management or a managed process while this herd continues to grow? And if there is, if it is found that there is chronic waste disease, well then, and I remember that the chairman had mentioned a double fence, you know, to be able to contain that. So those are just a couple questions that they could answer.
Representative Kozlowski.
Great. Thank you, Chair and Representative, for those really great questions. In fact, we've been having those conversations. I know that the Fond du Lac Band, as well as the Minnesota DNR, who's here with us as well, to speak in support and speak specifically to that funding piece, but also the planning and looking to the new report that's going to be coming out on CWD. But I'll actually pass this off to Chair Dupuy to be able to share more.
Chair Dupuy.
Thank you. I think one of the most important pieces to this is how CWD has moved throughout the country. The process and with it is most of this land that where it has is getting the reintroduction of the elk. The fencing piece of double fencing is based on cervid animals. This is going to be a complete wild herd. This is not a farm animal. The principle of the double fencing, and I use that argument as the low-hanging fruit to do that part of it, is to have the double fencing. The testing process that goes has to be more rigorous than it's ever been done. I can tell you that right now, especially after hearing the report. I think everybody has a really big eye-opener on that. So the process that exists right now and how they transport the animals, there's going to be co-management through all the organizations that are part of it. It won't be just Fond du Lac. It won't be just the Minnesota DNR. The important pieces that need to be watched. I can't guarantee anything up to that point of how CWD is going to be, but what we can take a look at is the research that's coming back that we all need to move forward with this, and that goes with any wild animals that we have or any kind of reintroduction, and most importantly, any active cervid farms that we have. We have to find and learn a new way to seclude these, and most importantly, the principles of testing. And we all know that the word that we had the other day on how it works, it's not a parvo principle that we were told at the beginning where it's dormant in the earth for 5 to 7 years. You were actually looking at a principle of 15 years. So this gives ability to work from the point now to moving forward, but also going backwards to take a look at what happened and how it transfers. As an actual wild herd, if the double fencing from all farms under that manner, meaning that the cervid farms, we know right now it doesn't transfer into domestic animals. We know that the cervid farms are right now are the only ones that do it. So our concern isn't that great at that point right now with it. But I know that in the future, however this reintroduction goes, there will be constant monitoring of this like it's never been seen before. And I think that's what we all have to look at that and understand that the importance of CWD, without knowing all the multipliers that belong with CWD, but with the things that we do have, gives us a base to move forward. I hope I answered my question or your question.
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that this is a good project, and just to that point, you know, I'm glad that Representative Kozlowski have this in the language to make sure that the DNR is working with the Fond du Lac band to make sure that we do have this cervical disease management, so I'm really glad to see that this is included in there.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Anson. I think this would be a question for the bill author. I'm kind of concerned as the only member who's got elk in their district now, I'm kind of worried about how beyond the fencing, you're talking about double fencing. I'm more worried about the fencing of our farmers and guys, you know, ranching up north. So would folks in your area be able to access those funds for elk depredation? Right now that has actually surpassed our wolf depredation funding up in northwest Minnesota, or in the state. So I'm curious how you'd see that working. I'm assuming they would be. And then my only concern would be, you know, how much that fund needs to expand in the future if we're going to continue to expand these elk herds.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And Representative, and just to clarify, we're talking about the damage from crop damage.
Damage, yeah.
And I have been in touch. Thank you for that. It's a great question. I've been in touch with the Department of Agriculture. And while northeastern Minnesota doesn't have quite the prevalence, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And so there is that crop damage fund that is available through Department of Agriculture. As to the specific expansion, I don't believe that's in the bill. I believe that NDA may have been on tap. Yes, we'll be able to call. I'd ask you to, if you could expand more about the availability of those funds and what those dollar amounts are.
Commissioner Vobel or? Welcome, state your name for the record.
Mark Abrahamson, the Plant Protection Director at Department of Agriculture. So we have the elk claims are within plant protection. So, we have an appropriation that we use to pay claims for elk damage to crops and fences. The claims have been going up, so this biennium, actually, we've surpassed the amount that's appropriated for elk. We do have the flexibility. We have another appropriation that pays depredation from wolves, and we can move money back and forth between those funds as needed. So this year we'll be helping to cover elk claims with money from the wolf appropriation.
Representative Burkle.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Hansen. That would be my only concern moving forward as we go here, knowing that the elk depredation claims are surpassing wolf claims now. Thank you.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Kozlowski, I'm glad you're here, and special thanks to the chairman for coming and working on this issue. This is something that I've worked on in the past as well. We'd really like to see elk coming back in some of these areas that can hold elk, and I think especially well. One of the things that I have been pushing for, and it appears to be addressed in this bill, Representative, previously we had talked about a study and moving that process forward with DNR, but with a larger appropriation, it sounds like we can actually move elk, and I'm just curious because I'm somewhat excited about this. I too have harvested elk meat specifically for feeding my family. It would have been nice to see something bigger, but I was very, very thankful to take home a cow in my particular case. But are we talking about X number of elk that can be moved, and what does that look like?
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and Representative Heinzman. I agree and look forward to the day where we can continue to restore these animals. I mean, I remember in my reservation where we would have moose stands because the moose are plentiful. In terms of the exact amount of deer that we'll be moving, I'd actually like to call up Chair Dupuy to come back up and speak a little bit more about what that looks like in terms of being able to have a management plan that's going to transition to our area.
Chair Dupuy.
Chair, representatives, it's 20 to 25 elk at a time for its movement. There'll be time for the elk to be reintroduced to the area, monitored, assessed, and at that point in time to determine if at that point in time they're ready to move another additional amount of elk into the area. There's no guarantee from the beginning of it that the 20 to 25 elk that enter the area is going to be secured to that point, but it is a monitoring issue, it's a management issue, and I think honestly it's probably the best way to do it. Instead of overpopulate or send a population in there that you have no idea what is going to happen with it. And we take a look at Tennessee, is one state that really was able to do that and do it the right way. And I think if Minnesota kind of follows on that shirt tail under that manner, to bring animals in that you can manage, and manage only the animals that you can manage, and make the assessments from there to determine that if within the next year, whatever their time frame becomes, is to reintroduce another small number of animals, and I believe that would be also the same number, 20 to 25. We're not looking at something that's going to come in and have this big, huge, overzealous, and overpopulated principle. The other questions that come back, and we're going to do for the analysis, is the predatory issue that comes with elk, and how, what is your calving season going to look like? And right now, nobody knows them answers. But I think within the first season of having elk, the first year, the numbers are going to really be able to be determined at that point in time. So there is a management plan for it. There is a process, and the amount of elk that are going to be reintroduced at a time in different phases. I hope that answered the question.
Representative Scraba, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Chairman. One of the things I'm curious about is, I know I've been involved. I'm from Ely, the whole area, Grand Portage area. I've been the Adik, the Ojibwe, the caribou, woodland caribou. Are they part of any long-term plan? How do they work with the elk? You know, that sort of thing, because I know that's native to our area, the woodland caribou. They've been in there for, they moved north, supposedly. But, and since I want to try to rush this through, any chance of this making it to the boundary waters as far as habitat goes? And obviously, how are we going to manage the predators amongst these guys, because I know I too harvest animals out west and I bring them home and eat them, but the number when the wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone and that area, the herds got decimated. They're still there, but they're not as many as there used to be, and I'm just curious how we're all going to work together on this, because I too want to see them. I'm all for it. I just there's a lot of questions, so I feel like I just need to ask them. Thank you.
Chair Dupuy.
Chair Representative, thank you for the question. I think it's very important. We know at this point in time that there's a wild herd of caribou across the border. The caribou have not been in our region substantially or significantly in a very, very long time. For the ones who are interested in the LIDAR and seeing the old LIDAR, the LIDAR images, you can see trails that still go through the bog swamps, and most of them trails were the woodland caribou that lived in our region. But we need to remember that the time that we're asking to do right now, that the elk, moose goose, moose, and the woodland caribou, or adik, that is the Ojibwe names for them three animals, all thrived in this region at one time. The predators have always existed here. Wolf is one thing to our people as the Mayingan. The story with the wolf is a simple story. Whatever happens to the wolf happens to us as man. I think the important piece that we need to understand is that what happened in Yellowstone was absolutely a mismanaged. I don't know if that's the right word to use. I think you can use the term, it was ignored. It was ignored to a point of that. And so I think the way we are moving in the day and times that we are today, I think there's a wolf plan that it does exist in the state of Minnesota, and I believe that all reservations or tribes within the state of Minnesota have their own management plan if they have to execute that management plan. And I think with the organizations that are going to be part of it, the band, the DNR, Department of Ag, I think we're all smart enough to come up with something to look at past history that didn't work to ensure that we can move forward so these animals can thrive. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yep.
Representative Kozlowski, closing.
Oh, closing statement. Well, again, I just want to say thank you so much for the opportunity to have this bill heard, and to Chair and your team for making the drive down from Fond du Lac. There are many co-benefits, as we've talked about with this bill here, benefits from viewing and being able to have a potential economic boost from folks coming into the area. It will be, you know, opportunity for tribal and non-tribal members to be able to participate in hunting. But bottom line, as we've heard, is that these elk, these amoshkus have been here, and we have an opportunity right now to be able to bring them back in co-managed way with Minnesota DNR, with property owners, with the public, to make sure that it's done in a way that is safe and takes into account all the different factors that need to go into doing this right and doing this well. And I look forward to the day that we're able to have this introduced into our diet again and into our cultural practices. You know, we do things as looking at the next seven generations and thinking about our grandparents and our community members who are able to be in relationship with the elk in our area, and to be able to hear them again, to see them again, and to have that relationship restored and reclaimed for our future way of life and sustained for our area. So thank you again, and ask for your support for this bill.
I renew my motion that House File 1423 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you. Next up, House File 921, Representative Finke, use of insecticides on state lands prohibited. We have about 15 minutes for this bill. Representative Finke, would you like to move that House File 921 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
I would.
Representative Finke, to the bill.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. House File 921 is a simple one-sentence bill that prohibits the use of neonicotinoid insecticides on public lands in the state of Minnesota. The neonic class of insecticides is the most commonly used pesticide across the world. These pesticides are highly toxic to the insects they target, and they are destroying our pollinators, and they are impacting all of our natural resources. These pesticides are found in our surface water and our groundwater. They're found in mammals in every part of the state, regardless of that animal's proximity to their use. In 2021, a DNR study found neonic insecticide in 94% of sampled deer. In 64% of those sampled deer, there were concentrated levels of contamination above the level shown to negatively affect fawn survival. This contamination is not only in wildlife. A 2022 study led by Jesse Buckley at Johns Hopkins found 90% of pregnant people have neonics in their bodies. The highest levels were found among Hispanic women. We know there are reasons to address these pesticides, and this bill is a small but meaningful step toward that action. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
First up, Chris Cowan, Pesticide Action Network.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Cowan, and I'm a contract lobbyist with the Pesticide Action Network. I'll keep my testimony very brief. As Representative Finke said, and I think it bears repeating, that a DNR study from Wildlife Research annual project progress report, which is in the packets, 94% of the submitted samples of deer spleens from harvested deer had neonics in them, which to me is pretty astounding. And 64% of those samples having that concentration that's shown to be negatively impacting fawn survival. And it's regardless of location in the state. You don't have to be near where agricultural use is. You don't have to be near where urban use is, non-agricultural use. It's across the state. The only other point on that same theme from this report, and I encourage everybody to at least look this over a bit, the writers include this. Finally, neonic exposure appears to be ubiquitous across our study sites, indicating our original study design of comparing fawn survival and adult movements between areas of low neonic exposure and areas of high neonic exposure is infeasible. In other words, there's so much neonic in the state, they couldn't come up with a baseline. They couldn't compare the low to the high. It was all too high. So I think we do in this state. I think we have a pesticide problem. I think the legal use of pesticides, neonics and chlorpyrifos, the legal use of those products is causing this problem. It's not the illegal use. It's the legal use as provided by federal law. And I think here in Minnesota we need to do better. And a great place to do this would be on our natural lands. And I believe our next testifier will talk about those places being one of the only refuges we have where we can assure that there isn't use. Thank you. Thank
you. Greg Larson, Minnesota Environmental Partnership.
On behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership and the Pollinator Friendly Alliance, thank you for the opportunity to speak on support of House File 921. Our state is not immune from the biodiversity crisis that's impacting the entire planet. You're probably familiar with the depressing statistics surrounding the demise of once common insects like bumblebees and monarch butterflies and grassland birds like meadowlarks and bobolinks, birds once common but now locally extinct in parts of Minnesota, and that's certainly the situation around our farm. Habitat has disappeared to the extent that most remaining undisturbed wetlands, grasslands, and high-quality woods are on state or federal property. For that reason, public lands must be managed in a way that reflects their critical importance as the last refuge for biodiversity. One simple step to protecting biodiversity on state land is the elimination of systemic pesticides and to codify that into law. Systemic pesticides are by design bad for wildlife, but the neonicotinoid class of pesticides are especially pernicious, as you've heard. The use of neonics in agriculture and horticulture and home use has exploded in just the last 20 years. But by far the biggest environmental inputs of neonics is coating on agricultural crop seed, especially corn, soybean, and wheat. Neonics are picked up by birds and other animals by ingesting exposed coated seed, or because of the high solubility, the insect easily washes from the seed, contaminating surrounding land, streams, and wetlands. The normal corn soybean rotation common in row crop production means that there's a continuous annual use of neonics. One of the most common neonics used in seed coating, clothianidin, has a half-life of over 900 days, meaning half the chemical remains after 3 years. These pesticides are rapidly accumulating in the environment. The harm of systemic pesticides to pollinators and migratory birds is well documented, but more recent research is showing that pesticide harm is moving through the food chain. As you've already heard, the DNR has found neonics in white-tailed deer at levels surpassing results from a South Dakota State University research that linked neonic to behavior changes, reduced reproductive organ size, and low fawn survival rates. Subsequent research at SDSU found that neonics negatively affect the survival of pheasants, and research conducted by Charlotte Roy of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources found high levels of neonics in Minnesota sharp-tailed grouse and prairie chickens. Remember that many state DNR lands have been purchased or donated by sports people and taxpayers for the benefit of wildlife. So I'll finish with this. Our position is simple. It is just plain wrong for the state to allow the use or use wildlife-harming pesticides on public land now critical to sustaining biodiversity. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to questions. Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, just to confirm, do we have 6 minutes for questions? Is that correct?
You have 6 minutes for questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully that's enough time. Representative Finke, this is something that we've heard on a number of occasions, this bill. I'm not sure that it was in this exact language, but I always like to try and better understand how widespread this problem is. Do you know, Representative Finke, what pesticides are currently used on state lands and which pesticides?
Representative Finke.
I'm sorry, the question was, thank you, Chair and Representative, what pesticides?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Heinz.
Yeah, what pesticides are currently being used on state lands and where?
I don't know the answer to that, but I have a feeling, Representative, you have the answer, so I would love to learn.
We do have DNR in the audience if they would like to come forward. Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. It'd be nice to have an idea how widespread this problem is.
I think Representative Jordan may have the answer. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Heintzman. This is identical language to a bill I carried in the previous biennium. I don't know the details of the pesticide use that the DNR has, but I do know that they do not currently have a practice of using neonicotinoids or chlorpyrifos on public land. The exceptions I heard last year was there might be a random can somewhere, and that would be atypical. The other use I have heard in the past has been in attempts with emerald ash borer, and I know there was an agreement that we reached in previous years to accommodate that, and my understanding is the bill is being laid over, and I would be happy to work with Representative Finke on that amendment that was adopted last year.
Dr. Straka, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Kelly Straka. I am the Wildlife Section Manager with the DNR, Minnesota DNR.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think that it's important that this committee helps the public understand what problems legislation being proposed is targeted towards addressing. And in this case, and that's why I asked the question, I wouldn't want the public to be under the impression that somehow this is something that's happening everywhere in the state if that wasn't the case. So that's why I ask, where is these particular pesticides that would be prohibited from being used, where is it being used if it currently is? And it sounds like Representative Jordan addressed that, is that it isn't being used currently on public lands or state lands specifically. So if that's incorrect, I'm happy to be corrected.
Dr. Straka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, members of the committee. In 2017, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources issued a letter to those producers that we work with on our state wildlife management areas. These are the areas that you may be referring to that are purchased for active management of habitat, for hunting, trapping, other outdoor-related recreation. In 2017, we did send a letter to private cooperators, farmers that we use to partner with, and that may be planting crops and other activities for the benefit of wildlife and certainly hunting opportunity on our WMAs. We did that year send a letter banning the use of neonicotinoid pesticides as well as fungicides and other chemicals on treated seed used on those properties. So I can say that in the 1.4 million acres of WMAs, about 12,000 acres of those do have cooperative farming agreements on them, but the usage of those chemicals that we're talking about here are banned on those particular units.
Representative Heintzman, would you like me to go to Representative Jacob, who also asked a question?
I may have a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, but go ahead. No, go ahead if you'd like to go to Representative Jacob.
Thank you. So, thank you, Chair Hansen. And in my district, Whitewater Wildlife Management Area, when these non-neonic seeds were introduced, we had literally thousands of acres of Whitewater Wildlife Management Areas planted into food plots that would feed the wildlife, feed the deer especially. And the farmers immediately transitioned out of putting those plots in anymore. We see very few of those plots being planted anymore, just due to the ineffectiveness or that, you know, no ability for the farmer to have any profit in those areas. So now the problem that we have in my area is all these, you know, thousands of deer are now predators on the surrounding areas, the crop farmers in the area, which of course are not prohibited from using neonics. So it seems like the problem is just displacing it from state land onto private land, and meanwhile really producing a large amount of deer depredation on private property. So would the author of the bill consider like introducing any type of language that would encourage organic or non-neonic seeds to be planted and mandatorily reinstate these areas that have been taken out of production on wildlife management areas?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. We are laying the bill over, as Representative Jordan said, and if there are other concerns with the bill, I would be very happy to hear them.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we're all working towards the same goal here. It's just important to note that these chemicals are not being used on state land currently, so we may not require legislation to make a change that doesn't apparently exist, but or doesn't get at a problem that currently exists. But I think I understand what you're working towards, Representative.
Representative Finke, any closing comments?
Well, I would just like to take a moment to respond, and I appreciate what you're I also appreciate what you're getting at, and I think that one of the things that we recognize when we make laws is that management plans can change very quickly, and what agencies may consider worth using or not using could change also. So if we have values that we want to put into our codify those values into law, then that's what we should do, and we should expect that to be the case 10, 20 years later, no matter who's running our agencies. So, for what it's worth.
Any closing comments, or was that the close?
We'll let that close.
Representative Finke renews her motion that House File 921 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Bill is laid over. Next up, and House File 1000, Representative Brand, PFAS prohibited. And members, the last two bills and the next two bills, there is a large amount of testimony that has been provided in writing, and those are posted on the committee website. So in addition to the public testimony, there's public written testimony as well. Representative Brand, I've timed this out till about 4:10 p.m. Would you like to move that House File 1000 be recommended to be referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee?
Yes, that's my motion.
And Representative Brand, I believe you have a DE2 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the DE2 amendment. And so the original draft of the language that I created for House File 1000 was reviewed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and largely it seems to be adoptable language that the MPCA can implement. There's been a couple of changes to it to make it easier to implement based off of their feedback. Also, I want to point out in Subdivision 5 under Prohibitions, I've actually included menstruation products at the urgency of Representative Jordan, and then also from previous testimony, I think on January 31st, I added dental floss, finding out that it's in dental floss. So that is the amendment as it stands.
Representative Brand moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Representative Brand to the bill. The DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Brand to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have thought about 1,000 different ways for this testimony to go this afternoon about what I could say, and honestly, I could probably fill hours and hours, but we don't have hours and hours. And so, you know, a lot of the members in this committee have heard a bill like this before. I shouldn't say it like this. I should say elements of this bill. But the urgency, nonetheless, is still there. We have an issue in the state of Minnesota that we have to address. Well, across the globe, we have an issue that we have to address. We only have the purview of Minnesota to address it. And I look at this specific piece of legislation as a consumer protection bill, as well as an environmental protection bill for Minnesota. And so perfluoroalkyl alkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances are also known as forever chemicals, or PFAS is a short term. They're everywhere. They were made in Minnesota. They were invented in Minnesota. In 2018, we found out that they were dumped in Minnesota. Unsafe levels of toxic chemicals are present in rainwater, and there's headlines and research about that around the globe. According to new studies published in the Environmental Science and Technology, some levels of these toxic chemicals are of concern. These chemicals are found in our waters, our fish. The DNR posted a rainbow smelt fish advisory which impacts our indigenous folks who also use that same source of food, and even a lot of our game species. So our Wisconsin folks to the east have tested their deer, their ducks, and geese for PFAS, and as a result have issued a do not eat advisory for deer liver around Marionette, which is about 55 miles north of Green Bay. So that's just within our region. I want to kind of start this testimony by talking to you a little bit about the history of PFAS. It was invented, of course, in Minnesota in the 1940s. By the 1960s, there were other folks that were also producing this compound or these classes of compounds. According to U.S. House Appropriations Committee hearing testimony dated 3/21 of 2021, in 1966, the Food and Drug Administration rejected a petition by DuPont to use PFAS in food as a food additive. And they cited liver studies when they rejected the proposal. Meaning, this is important, some federal agencies knew about emerging risks of PFAS back then. And administrations going forward of both sides of the aisle, nothing has really been done at the federal level. In 1999, 3M notified the EPA that PFOS accumulated in the bloodstream and provided data that indeed liver damage was confirmed in rats. Later information also showed that they had internal research about fish and also the eaglets that ate the fish or the eagles that ate the fish as well. So that showed a connection in the ecosystem in our state. In 2009, the federal EPA released a provisional health care advisory warning of exposure to these toxic chemicals. In 2014, the European Chemical Agency Risk Assessment Committee classified these toxic chemicals as a hazardous substance, characterizing it as a suspected carcinogen known to be toxic. In 2023, the European Union is considering a full-on ban of these chemicals in the entirety of Europe. That's over 10,000 chemicals they're looking to ban at once. In 2018, of course, the state of Minnesota settled a state lawsuit with 3M to the tune of $850 million. There is solid evidence that PFAS exposure is harmful to human health and the environment. In fact, according to Colorado testimony from 2019 on Bill 19-1279, PFAS chemicals do not break down in the environment and are toxic to people and wildlife at very low levels. Ingesting even small amounts can cause cancer and serious health problems. Exposure to PFAS is linked to kidney and testicular cancer, thyroid problems, pregnancy complications, high cholesterol, immune system disorders. Firefighters, first responders, and our veterans in this nation have been exposed to hazardous amounts of these chemicals, as we heard in previous week's testimony. And nearly every American has measurable amounts of PFAS in their body. According to the EPA website, there is evidence that exposure to PFAS has led to adverse outcomes in humans. Current scientific research suggests that exposure to high levels of certain PFAS may lead to adverse health outcomes, as I mentioned before. Research is also underway to better understand the health effects associated with low levels over long periods of time, especially in our children. In 2021, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency issued a PFAS blueprint, outlining a three-pronged strategy for addressing PFAS here in this state. The first step is mitigation. That's what I'm here to talk to you about today. The second step is management. And the third step is cleanup. This legislation tackles the step one, and you'll hear later in testimony, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is supportive of House File 1000. The MPCA tested for PFAS in groundwater at 101 out of 110 sites in the closed landfill program. PFAS is now detected in 98 landfills. At 59 of those landfills, PFAS levels exceed Minnesota Department of Health drinking water guidance standards. This bill addresses one specific issue, turning off the tap. For everything that's in the consumer chain, the PFAS that's contained within them would go through the process until 2025, and there would be a hard stop for sales in the state of Minnesota under this legislation. What I will share with you is that in doing all of my research, scientific studies show that in the infant cord blood, it's there. It's in breast milk that women provide to their babies. It's in our rain, it's in our snow, it's in our lakes or rivers or streams, and also in our soil. It's a forever chemical, which means it binds to water, it binds to soil, it does not go away. There are very costly and cost prohibitive technologies that are available, but right now there is no effective strategy to actually remove PFAS from our soil or our water. Also, I have to point out that there is a series of pieces of litigation. In fact, if you Google PFAS legislation or PFAS litigation 2013, you'll find 408,000 results. There are states who are looking to do a lot of different things about this particular crisis that we face across our country. There are 31 states who are actively looking at legislation to address the situation in their states. There is a Stateline article that actually was released today. 12 states are considering bills related to chemicals and cosmetics, which is in my bill. 19 states will likely introduce to eliminate harmful chemicals from plastics and packaging, which the legislature already did in 2021. 11 states have floated bills related to PFAS in food contact materials. Legislators in 8 states are proposing restrictions or requiring disclosure of PFAS. Some states will consider a ban on PFAS in firefighting foam, just as we heard a couple weeks ago. Some states are working on policies related to testing, cleanup, water quality standards, and accountability. 11 states are crafting bills related to water quality testing and disclosure, including a proposal in Maine that would require testing of bottled water. 10 states are considering proposals to fund PFAS cleanup efforts. According to political reporting last year, eliminating PFAS from drinking water sources alone will cost $400 billion, with a B. I did some research, so the Department of Health actually has a website where you can search their test results of drinking water in communities across our state. Representative Chair Hansen, South St. Paul Park has 10 different types of PFAS in their water, 3 in Newport and 1 in St. Paul. Representative Jordan and Representative Lee, 3 are in Minneapolis. Representative Heintzman in Brainerd, there is 1 that's been tested. Representative Edelson has 3 in Bloomington and 6 in Edina, where she represents. Representative Finke and Fisher each have 1, because I assume that water from St. Paul also goes into Representative Fisher's district. Representative Jacob, there's 1 in Zumbrota, 4 in Plainview, and 4 also in the Rochester area. Representative Purcell, there's 1 in New Prague and 1 in Northfield. Representative Schultz, there's 5 in Uppsala, 7 in Rice, 6 in Foley, and 1 in Ogilvie. And Representative Scraba, there's 1 in Little Fork and 1 in White Lakes. And Representative Vang, 5 in Brooklyn Center. Now, these are detectable amounts. There are 60 communities in our state that have public water drinking systems that exceed EPA's new advisory level for water quality standards. That's where I want to end right now, and I would welcome testifiers to come to the table.
Thank you, Representative Brand. We have a number of testifiers. First up, Amara Strande.
Greetings, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Amara Strandy, and a few weeks ago I shared some of my experiences living with stage 4 fibrolamellar hepatocellular carcinoma, an extremely rare form of liver cancer with no cure. I told you of the horrific nightmares I endured during my month-long coma, the foot-long scar across my abdomen, and the excruciating pain in my now lifeless, crippled right arm and hand. But as you can imagine, I only began to scratch the surface of the life I've been living these last 5 years. I didn't get to tell you of the many rounds of chemo, immuno, and radiation therapy I endured, only for them to fail. Or the 3-foot-long scar spanning from the top right side of my chest, down the middle, and that ends at my navel. I didn't get to tell you of how devastating my diagnosis was for my family, my relationship with my little sister, and my community. I now get to let you imagine how it might have felt being 16 and hearing a classmate retell the heavy, dark, looming cloud that floated over the school as everyone anxiously awaited to hear if I finally woke up or if I eventually died. I don't mean to sound self-centered, but from the very beginning, my cancer deeply affected my community. Cancer has had a prominent place in my community. I attended Tartan Senior High School, and any student that attended within the last 20 years can tell you just how big of a deal Relay for Life is at that school. At first, you may notice and even appreciate the genuine care students put into raising money for their teams. But eventually, it doesn't feel like a coincidence anymore when Tartan Relay for Life, year after year, is ranked in the top 5 to 10 in the country for raising money for cancer research. It became common to watch a student or a teacher break down in class because someone they love is suffering or has recently died from cancer. At the beginning of 2020, during my senior year, 4 students in my senior class of around 300 had a parent die from cancer. By then, I had learned I wasn't the only student who underwent or was living through a cancer diagnosis. In 2018, an article by the Sydney Morning Herald found that over the past 15 years, 21 students at Tartan High School were diagnosed with cancer. At least one student at Tartan will be diagnosed with cancer a year. I can easily sympathize with my grieving classmates. Being one of those 21 cancer patients, I saw the need and I developed a peer-led cancer support group for my school, Tartan Cancer Alliance. Looking back, I'm stunned that burying a classmate or their loved one because of cancer was a regular occurrence for us. It wasn't just the norm. It always was and had been the norm for my community. "Don't drink the 3M cancer water," became the running joke at my high school. We all knew the rumors of the dumped toxic chemicals plaguing our drinking water. We all knew cancer was affecting our community to a disturbing degree. Yet, until very recently, nobody did the due diligence to investigate and put two and two together. I can't prove if 3M is guilty of the public health crisis that has plagued my community for nearly 60 years. However, companies like 3M can step up and be the creative leaders we need for us to live PFA-free lives. It doesn't matter to corporate America if the bill passes or falls flat. Companies like 3M will walk away from this as billion-dollar corporations. But now, speaking to these corporations directly, this is your chance. To be a leader among billion-dollar corporations that saves lives by rebuilding the community you built from the ground up. By rebuilding the community that built you from the ground up. Or you can walk away as another billion-dollar company concerned with its own damage control. If you were ever a student in School District 622, you know 3M found its way into the classroom, promoting STEM activities and daily 3M product needs. Banning PFAs in non-essential items will be hard. A system will need to be developed to determine what items are non-essential and, of course, develop a way to hold manufacturers of non-essential items accountable for ending the use of PFAs in their products. It only seems natural that we should see a corporation like 3M who promoted solving what's hard to fifth grader me rise to the occasion as leaders in innovation. Now is your chance to shine. Chair Hansen and members of the committee, please help my voice and the voices of my community in supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Strandy.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, my name is Michael Strandy, and I am the father of Amara Strandy. In coming before this committee today, Amara is not being paid by anyone, and she isn't seeking an advance in a career. The only compensation she will receive for using her precious energy to be here is knowing that she has done something that will help others avoid having to struggle with a debilitating and deadly disease by convincing you that the non-essential use ban presented before you will save lives. The non-essential use ban is not simply a bill that will prevent companies from doing business. The bill is not simply about whether companies will be limited to the production and selling of certain products. The bill that you are being asked to accept is one that deeply affects human life. The banning of PFAS from non-essential products is an issue that protects the value and dignity of human life. In the banning of PFAS in non-essential products such as shampoos, cookware, hygiene products, children's toys, and of course the list goes on and on, we will be protecting the lives of unborn infants still in the womb, protecting children who play with toys, young girls who use makeup, factory workers who handle these products on a daily basis. You will be protecting people who eat fast food that is wrapped in grease-resistant paper, people who use dental floss, or those who inhale fumes from paint, varnishes, and sealants. By diminishing the number of products that contain PFAS, we'll decrease the number of products that will end up in our landfills and seep these chemicals into the groundwater. Will the billion-dollar corporations take a hit financially if the non-essential bill is passed? Certainly, they will take a hit. But we do not need to protect the billion-dollar corporations. Whatever legislation is passed that limits what they are able to produce and sell, they will still find a way to be a billion-dollar corporation. It is true that 3M stated that they will stop using certain types of PFAS in the products they produce. 3M manufactures a type of PFAS called short-chain chemicals, which are named based on the length of their molecules. Some manufacturers are opting to replace the more commonly known long-chain PFAS with short-chain alternatives. It is not clear if the alternatives are more or less hazardous to human health. This means they could be replacing one deadly chemical with another deadly chemical. There has not been any long-term studies to determine the safety of these products. 3M will use these chemicals until they show that they do harm people. What is this presupposition based on? The 3M track record over the past 60 years. What makes you think they will self-regulate? In the 1950s, 3M knew the newly discovered chemicals were dangerous. If they really cared about the harm they would cause, they would have stopped to use them then. In their own research in the 1960s, they found that these chemicals did not degrade in the environment. If they cared about the environment, they would have stopped using them at that time. In the 1970s, 3M scientists knew these chemicals were a threat in causing cancer in humans. If they cared about human life, they would have stopped using them at that time. In the 1980s, one of 3M's chemists wrote this warning in a memo about these chemicals. Quote, taken together, stability, the tendency to bioaccumulate and biological activity are a potentially troublesome combination, end quote. If they cared about the use of their chemicals would make people sick, they would have stopped at that time. In the 1990s, 3M's manager of corporate toxicology wrote that, quote, these compounds are very persistent and thus insidiously toxic, end quote. If they cared that the use of these chemicals would cause cancer in children, they would have stopped at that time. By the early 2000s, 3M was more concerned about their reputation than protecting the kids at Tartan High School and their families from deadly cancers. I ask again, what makes you think 3M or other billion-dollar corporations will self-regulate? The questions you ought to be asking is not, will businesses be hurt because of this regulation? You ought to ask, when you see the child crying from the pain of her illness, am I willing to use the position I have to prevent another child from getting sick from these forever chemicals? The more important question you ought to ask is, if I am willing to hold the child as she dies in my arms, or is it more important for me to coddle the billion-dollar corporation? As a legislator, who needs your help? In the Jewish scriptures, it is understood that we are given the divine mandate to take care of those called the Anuim. Who are the Anuim? They are the vulnerable, the marginalized, and the socioeconomically oppressed. They are those who need our protection. They are the Amaras of the world. We are not ethically nor morally obligated to protect the billion-dollar corporations from their own lack of compassion and their lack of consciousness in doing what is right. Every major religion speaks how we are obligated by our conscience to act and be the voice for those who cannot speak for themselves. I urge you to support House File 1000. And thank you for letting me be here today.
Thank you. Derek Lowen.
Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Derek Lowen, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I guess I'm sorry for stammering. I'm nervous. I haven't spoken like this before. I should start with, I want to talk about my experiences with PFAS. I should start by saying that I was an infant when we moved into Oakdale. So I had exposure right from the beginning. My life dramatically changed in 2004. I started as a freshman at Tartan High School, and first, my best friend's sister was diagnosed with leukemia a few months before I started at Tartan. And after I started there, I realized how many people were getting sick, and we actually had a different social group that we had the cancer kids instead of jocks and whatnot and what else. In October of 2004, I believe it was October 6th, I learned I was joining them. So I had I was diagnosed with a brain tumor roughly the size of a baseball. It was a shock. They basically carted me off to Children's Hospital immediately in St. Paul. I was pumped full of steroids and other antibiotics and stuff to try to shrink the tumor, and then underwent a 8 or 9 hour surgery to remove it. The treatment was successful, but unfortunately, there are permanent effects from it. I am a traumatic brain injury, which is one of the reasons why I stammer a bit. I have permanent diminished motor skills, memory loss. I don't remember most of even family trip memories before 2004, which is sad. I have terrible balance and equilibrium. And shortly after my surgery, a senior at Tartan passed away from leukemia named Aaron Fowler. I believe 2007 might have been Nikki Shout passed away, I believe, from leukemia or another form of cancer as well. Many of these people were acquaintances and friends of mine. I'm not sure what else to say other than it's tragic being exposed to these chemicals that can cause such devastation to individuals and families. I mean, I can show you my the scars on the back of my head if you'd like. I can close with that. I don't know what else to say. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. Yeah. Ivana Stark, Clean Water Action.
Chair Hansen and members of the committee, I'm Ivana Stark, the State Director of Clean Water Action. Bans on products with PFAS are happening across the country, and we need to take urgent action before we become a dumping ground. There are 124 current policies in 23 states proposed, and 104 policies in 23 states that have been adopted related to the banning or restriction of the use of PFAS. 16 states are pursuing litigation against the manufacturers of PFAS chemicals for contaminating water supplies and other natural resources. 17 state attorney generals have called on the EPA to add PFAS to the chemical of significant concern list. Laws in Maine and Washington have given state agencies authority to ban PFAS in a wide range of products. 11 states have enacted phase outs of PFAS in food packaging. 5 states have adopted restrictions on PFAS in carpets, rugs, and aftermarket treatments, and regulatory action is pending on these products and other home textiles in Washington. Colorado adopted restrictions on indoor and outdoor furniture, as well as oil and gas products. California is phasing out PFAS in children's products, but you should know that they're sending them over the border to Arizona and putting them into the dollar stores for other children to play with. And Vermont has banned PFAS and ski wax. 11 states have put in place bans on the sale of firefighting foam containing PFAS. Don't be fooled by the razzmatazz of large chemical companies from DC and their allies, who fly in at a moment's notice to declare that they can't do the things that they have shown they can and have done in other states. As class action lawsuits pile up, public testimony can be used as evidence in those trials. We must ban the sale of products with PFAS in non-essential items in Minnesota or risk becoming a dumping ground for toxic products. We must reject the proposal of a sell-through date. Absolutely. We can't financially afford to keep paying to clean up a mess that we are continually adding to. And we can no longer afford the human toll these chemicals are taking. This is an expensive environmental mess that is now growing into a public health crisis. I urge your support for House File 1000. Thank you. Thank you.
R. Roger Ruin, University of Minnesota. Welcome, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Roger Ruin, I'm professor in bioproducts and biosystems engineering, also the director for Center for Biorefining at University of Minnesota. So my testimony is mainly on the cleanup of PFAS. So the cleanup of PFAS should be a two-pronged approach, both of which are crucial to its success. It's important to stop the flow of new PFAS into the environment, as well as clean up the existing PFAS, as these compounds can persist in the environment for a very long time and pose a threat to the fish, animal, and human health, as you have just heard. Now, PFAS removal from drinking water and environmental water bodies is actually achievable through this absorption, and there are some common and low-cost biochar and other carbon materials, minerals, polymers, and composite materials, and so on. So a filtration process can be added to remove the PFAS from the drinking water, with actually a smaller, you know, quite small filters can actually treat a lot of the drinking water, because the level of the PFAS in the drinking water is usually quite low, so but just need to be done. And also for the environmental water bodies, the use of, you know, biochar and other low-cost materials as soil amendment and so on, it could actually reduce the soil erosion, stormwater runoff also, but also, again, absorb these and could even break down the PFAS. And there are some newly developed modified materials that have, you know, these enzymes can break down these also. And these materials can also be used as a filter media in the water body to absorb and stabilize the PFAS. And these materials, after it's done, after it's used, the filter materials, they can be catalytically pyrolyzed, okay? So, you know, when they catalytically pyrolyzed, then these PFAS, they are break down to turn into fluorinated gases or these minerals, okay? So then they can be, you know, and then there will be some gas can be scrubbed with water, so it should, you know, be able to destruct it. Now, in addition to removing the PFAS, it is also crucial to stop the flow of new PFAS and the nano and microplastics into the environment. These can be achieved by removing the PFAS containing materials and other waste plastics, for example, from the environment, from the oceans and the all kind of water bodies, and convert them into fuels or high-value chemicals. And there are actually companies already start to do that using this pyrolysis technology that, you know, we actually patented already at the University of Minnesota. And these will actually create economic incentives to remove these materials from the environment. So that way you can remove them, you can utilize them. So this way, you know, it can actually prevent them from actually entering the environment. So we just need a regulation to actually stop them going into the environment. Then, you know, with these kind of additional technology to utilize them, to convert them into high value, you know, chemicals, and other fuels and so on. So I do think we can actually help solve these problem also. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Jay Eidsness, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I want to just make sure that people are addressing House File 1000 as a member. Welcome. I'll state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Committee members, my name is Jay Eidsness, and I am an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I would like to begin my testimony in support of House File 1000 by reminding the committee of a few fundamental truths about PFAS. First, PFAS are harmful to human and environmental health in alarmingly small concentrations. For decades, thousands of Minnesotans have been on the front lines of this public health crisis, drinking tainted water, consuming contaminated fish, and using an array of household products we now know have been fortified with these toxic chemicals. This bill helps assure Minnesotans that the cosmetics, textiles, and other products they use every day are not laced with forever toxic forever chemicals. Second, source reduction is universally accepted as the primary way to stop these chemicals from entering the environment. While there are encouraging signs of emerging technologies that could be deployed to collect and eradicate PFAS from the environment, the easiest and most practical way is to cut off the flow of PFAS at the source. This bill does exactly that. Third, relying on voluntary actions by chemical manufacturers like 3M, DuPont, Chemours to protect public and environmental health will fail. Despite long knowing that PFAS's persistence and toxicity presents unique and acute environmental and human health risks, 3M declined to cease production or fully disclose those facts until forced to through litigation. And we also now know that newer PFAS deemed safe alternatives like Gen X by chemical manufacturers like 3M are similarly toxic to the legacy PFAS like PFOA and PFOS that have been poisoning Minnesota's communities for years. We cannot rely upon corporate benevolence to solve this problem. I am not a scientist, but I am an environmental attorney. I know that litigation and legislation like House File 1000 motivate corporate change. I also know that contaminated drinking water, cancer clusters, and polluted surface waters unsuitable for fishing alone do not. News of 3M's decision to stop PFAS production must be viewed with skepticism given their history and the fact that other companies are poised to occupy whatever space 3M departs. This means that legislative action is needed. House File 1000 is a pragmatic response to a synthetic crisis created by the pursuit of corporate profit. The story of PFAS began in Minnesota, and eyes across the country and the world are looking to see how we rise to this moment. House File 1000 sends a clear message that Minnesota stands up for public and environmental health, and that spreading poison in our waters, fields, and bodies will be met with a strong response. I want to close my testimony with the adage, if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. Minnesota is in a hole. While this bill will not solve the PFAS problem, it does make the problem more manageable. It's past time for Minnesota to put down the shovel. Thank you.
Thank you. David Pelican, Conservation Minnesota. Next up after him, Tony Quillis, and then Tom Johnson, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Hansen and members, for the record, my name is David Pelican, and I'm the Policy Associate at Conservation Minnesota. I'm going to try and keep this under a minute. I want to go back to what Representative Brand said about the PCA's closed landfill program. I found that 97% of monitored landfill sites in Minnesota contain PFAS contamination. In Dakota County, in Hennepin, and Nicolet, Ramsey, St. Louis, Scott, Crow Wing, Kitson, Meeker, Winona, and Morrison, residents are living in close proximity to sites that show PFAS levels above health standards. And I hope we understand what this means. Due to unnecessary PFAS use, every member on this committee has constituents, adults, pregnant women, children, who make their meals on toxic cookware, who wash their hair with toxic shampoo, and put their kids to bed on toxic mattresses. Then they're throwing these products away to landfills where PFAS is leaching into their water supply, it's making them sick, and it's costing their communities millions in water treatment, and none of it is their fault. We know that PFAS is dangerous, we know that it's affecting Minnesotans, but still we have not passed reasonable, comprehensive legislation to solve this problem. Minnesota cannot, in good conscience, allow producers to continue to knowingly and avoidably sell non-essential toxic products to local families. This bill is an opportunity to take responsibility, to acknowledge an issue, and to fix it. So we respectfully urge your support for House File 1000. Thank you.
Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And members, we do not have a lot of flexibility on time today. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the DE2 for House File 1000, Mr. Chairman. Short of a national standard by the Environmental Protection Agency, which they're working on, Mr. Chairman, businesses would like to ensure that there is consistency and uniformity on regulations regarding PFAS across the nation and prevent a patchwork of reporting requirements and prohibitions on products. And to go back to when we talked about House File 372 earlier, which was Representative Holland's bill, there are 4,000 chemicals in this class, and not all of them are hazardous. There are different properties and different characteristics among these chemicals, and some of them never come in direct contact with humans. So regulating this chemical class, Mr. Chairman, as a one-size-fits-all is troubling and causes confusion among manufacturers. Estimates, again, our uses of this are 9 to 12,000. We talked about boats, electric vehicles, home appliances, electric, solar panels, wind turbines, Mr. Chairman. And under the reporting requirements of this, businesses, especially small to medium-sized businesses, would have to check with numerous suppliers to find something as small as a washer or a gasket. And don't forget that a single product could contain as many of 100 components that would be impacted by this, Mr. Chairman, because there is no de minimis standard in here. So just a mere trace would trigger the reporting requirement that's in this bill. And if there was a reporting requirement, Mr. Chairman, there is no assurance that the data would be proprietary information and trade secrets would be protected, Mr. Chairman. So again, the business community is looking for consistent, uniform regulations to prevent a patchwork across all states, Mr. Chairman. And I'll just draw attention to a couple of the sections in the bill that are to make this point. Mr. Chairman, when we talk about intentionally added and 2.1 to 2.13, that's different from House File 372. It is also different from the state of Maine that everybody seems to be referencing. Mr. Chairman, in terms of the juvenile product, I've been working with Representative Katiza Watoon on juvenile products on the de minimis section as well as in the direct contact for the exemptions, and that is different in this bill also. And then, Mr. Chairman, the definition of PFAS itself on the top of page 3 is different than House File 372 and also from the state of Maine. Mr. Chairman, in regards to the reporting requirements that are mentioned in this bill, Maine is probably the furthest along in this regards, and they had to grant 2,000 exemptions to the businesses when their reporting requirement was supposed to start January 1st, and they couldn't figure it out yet, and they're in the middle of a rulemaking, and there's an advisory group with stakeholders from the business community, regulatory agencies, and environmental groups to try and figure out what the ranges are and what those reports are going to entail. The testing requirements in here, Mr. Chairman, if you remember, I just mentioned there's 9 to 12,000 products and uses. There's no testing protocols for all of the products that are would be required under this, Mr. Chairman. Under the bans and prohibitions, I've never seen, Mr. Chairman, air care product included in cleaning products, and no other state in the nation bans cookware. California has a labeling requirement to it, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, in the exemption section that includes federal law, firefighting foam, food packaging, there is also the state of Maine exempts packaging. Mr. Chairman, the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse is working also on putting together a reporting portal. But I think the concern is, Mr. Chairman, just trying to be consistent and uniform on the regulations on and on the reporting. And as you pointed out earlier, Mr. Chairman, there to show the breadth and depth of this concern, there are letters in your packet from numerous other trade associations. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. I think you've got Mr. Johnson from the PCA behind me.
Tom Johnson, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll keep it very brief. Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1000. I'll just say PFAS as a class share an incredible persistence in the environment. Continued use of PFAS in industrial and commercial products will result in increased loading of these chemicals to the environment and our bodies. So prevention of the pollution of these chemicals is necessary to protect human health and the environment, which is the agency's core mission. Representative Brand mentioned the PFAS blueprint and its path for responding to PFAS contamination, prevent, manage, clean up. There's a very good reason that our highest priority is prevention, preventing these chemicals from entering our homes, businesses, and environment in the first place is by far the most health protective and cost-effective path forward. We can't afford to treat and clean our way out of the PFAS problem. As others have said, this bill will help turn off the tap. So I just want to thank the committee. We're very pleased to see the committee's attention focused on this important issue. So thank you, Chair Hansen. Also want to thank Representative Brand for bringing this bill forward and incorporating several of the agency's suggested changes to ensure a smooth implementation of the bill. We've had many conversations with the state of Maine and understand and believe we've addressed many of those challenges. And we're happy to continue to work with the author and other interested members as the bill moves forward. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Happy to stand for questions.
Before we go to questions, so we have limited time and we are going to do the other bill as well. This bill is going to Commerce, and then I will ask this bill come back to this committee after it has gone through Commerce. So I'm going to be real blunt here. If we have other testimony, we will not get this bill done today. I'm sorry. We just are not going to get it done today if we take other testimony. Questions. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Brand. When in your earlier comments, you mentioned that the only that this is only in the purview of Minnesota to address as an issue, and I think that you know we're all hearing from you know whether it be our constituents or others on different ways that this is going to be implemented and impact individuals and businesses alike. And it's not all billion-dollar businesses. There's a lot of little people running little businesses that are affected. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's going to be the very best way that has the most significant positive impact. And I know that other states are working on this. And I bring this up from time to time in this committee, and I'm not trying to be obnoxious. I just don't want a duplication of effort. I don't want to, you know, reinvent the wheel. So do you know, and I'm sure you've already looked at this, and you maybe could, you know, bring this back to the committee if you don't have it immediately to address, but do you know the requirements, you know, of this bill in terms of how it aligns with other legislation in other states? And the reason I ask is because, of course, a lot of products are being made on a large scale and being sold nationally. So I would love for this to be addressed, as Mr. Quillis was suggesting, at the national level. It sounds like that's in the works, but I'm not against what you're trying to do here. And at the same time, don't want to create a problem for all those many, many, many people that just want to do the right thing but could get caught up in a regulatory nightmare. And there's a lot of good language here, but there's some things that people are bringing to my attention that I know are going to potentially have a negative impact and not necessarily what you're intending to do, because what we're all working towards here is good. So if you could address that, Representative, that would be helpful.
Representative Brand.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman. You know, this question came up last year as well when we talked about specific issues dealing with, you know, commerce and the ability to sell these products. I guess, you know, I'm willing to work to address these issues in a way where we're not whacking people over the head that are selling these things. But at the same time, you know, number one, we don't know all the different products that contains PFAS. Apparently Mr. Quillis knows there's 9,000 products. I would really love to see that list, because I can tell you nationally there's nobody, no state knows exactly where PFAS is located, hence the need for disclosure in my legislation. Number two, I think it's really important that we address this issue, because our landfills are filling with this stuff. And I think at the end of the day, we have to, as a state, as I was referring to later, I can't say what goes on in Illinois. I can't say what goes on at the national level. We only have the purview of the border of Minnesota to address. And if there's any products that are coming into our state, if there's any products coming to our state from another country, for instance, that's where the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency comes in as well, to address these issues. And by giving them rulemaking authority, they can start batting stuff down on behalf of the consumers that reside in Minnesota. I think the biggest thing is that we have to start somewhere. And where we haven't acted in the last 10 to 15 or 20 or 30 or 50 years in the state is of consequence to our environment, which is the committee's purview, but also our individual health. And at some point, we have to draw a line in the sand. Some point, we need that leadership. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, now is the time to do what is right. And so now is the time to address this issue. I'm willing to work to do it, but 2025 is where I'm targeting. And I know a lot of people across the state are looking at it as saying, that's too far down the road. We need it sooner.
And Representative Brand, you will continue to work with Representative Heintzman.
Certainly.
On his concerns.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not trying to be obnoxious here, but I'm trying to get at making sure that if other states have addressed this in a meaningful way, that we could collaborate in our effort to make sure that Minnesota isn't an outlier nationally in a way that is going to be defeatist in its ultimate outcomes.
Sure.
We want to be successful in this effort. We do not want to fail. And quite honestly, if the bill is too broad, I'm worried that it doesn't make it across the line and we get nothing. So, gosh, we have to work towards getting something that we can actually find a way to implement.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're missing that, you know, unfortunately, we're missing the mark. And so that's why I asked the question, and it doesn't sound like you have an answer today. But, you know, as this continues moving forward, we're going to have to come to some kind of meaningful conclusion. And it may mean the bill has to change. And I hope that you can work with stakeholders to affect that. Because as I mentioned before, we're not just talking about billion-dollar companies. There's a whole lot of little people in the middle that want to do the right thing, and they need help.
Representative Brand, you're renewing your motion.
Yeah, I do have a small closing, too. I just, sorry to expend more time on this issue, but I think it's really important as we wrap this up today that I bring up a piece of an article, rather, that was written by Industry Today. And it was titled, Manufacturers Beware of Forever Chemicals. And it states, if you manufacture goods that require repellent to water, soil, oil, and the like, then good chances are you may be using or have used per or polyfluoroalkyl substances in your operations. And if you have used PFAS in your operation, you could very well find yourself caught in the crosshairs of the next PFAS lawsuit. I think that as we go forward, the state of California is suing over 110 manufacturers of this in just their state alone. They're becoming quite aggressive on it. Illinois, I think they're suing 14. We're going to have to address this situation. I'd prefer to do this. I think we also have a conversation that we need to have about medical monitoring. I think we also have to have a conversation about corporate responsibility in cleanup as well. And those are pieces of legislation we need to have a conversation about in this room. We can't have that until we pass this bill. Thank you very much.
President Brand renews his motion in House File 1000 as amended to be recommended to be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, so say no. The motion prevails. House File 1315, Representative Purcell, requirements for labeling items as biodegradable compostable.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I will be as brief as possible.
So, Representative Purcell, would you like to move that House File 1350 be recommended to be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee?
That is my motion, Chair.
And I believe you have an A1 amendment?
Indeed.
Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes. The A1 amendment, thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment makes some technical corrections and just clarifying of language is the hope.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Purcell, to discuss the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The goal of this bill is to reduce contamination we've seen too often at our composting facilities. This bill would work to build our precious soil instead of putting harmful microplastics into it. I would argue one of our most precious and non-renewable resources is indeed our soil. A couple of key definitions, and then I'm going to turn it over to some brief testifiers. Just to define compostable versus biodegradable. All compostable products are biodegradable, but not biodegradable products are compostable. So something's biodegradable. It can be broken down by naturally occurring microorganisms, such as bacteria and fungi. Every material will biodegrade given enough time, even sometimes centuries. Compostable materials, however, break down completely into their basic parts, such as water, carbon dioxide, and biomass. They'll break down in a timely manner and will not release harmful residue. I want to just note, I continue to be in conversation with the Minnesota Grocers Association and the Chamber of Commerce to make sure that we are looking at where the accountability is for this legislation. And now I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. I would ask that all three testifiers come forward to be at the table. Kelly Kish, Minnesota Composting Council, Chuck Joswiak, Specialized Environmental Technologies, and Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. If all three could come forward, maybe we can grab a couple extra chairs. Representative Lee, if you want to grab a.
All right, Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for fitting us in today. I will be brief as well. My name is Kelly Kish. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Composting Council. Minnesota Composting Council just turned 10 this year. We are a statewide nonprofit dedicated to advancing the composting industry through research, education, and market development. We've been working on this bill for the past several sessions and have, we think, worked very diligently to address any of the concerns raised by some of the past opponents. Some of those came in written testimony that was received for the hearing today. To keep my comments as brief as possible, I will say that we do feel this bill is a win for the environment. It's a win for residents. It's a win for businesses, as these misleadingly labeled products are commonly sold to restaurants, distribution companies, end up at residents, and then ultimately get to the compost sites, where it costs them significant amount of money to remove this material from the stream. It also costs significant amount of money in the reduction of the quality of compost they are able to produce in their operations. On our website, we do have a lovely 1.5-page FAQ that kind of goes over some of the questions and concerns that have been raised in the past on this bill. And a full list of our supporters is also available on that website. If you click their logo, it will pull up their individual letter of support for this bill as well. And with that, I will say thank you again, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing the bill forward for us.
Mr. Jaswiak.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Chuck Jaswiak, and our company, Specialized Environmental Technologies, is the largest privately owned compost operations in Minnesota. SET kept 44 million pounds of discarded food out of landfills last year, including materials from this capital complex here. HF 1315 is strictly aimed to curb greenwashing of terms and products and keep non-compostable garbage out of our compost sites. Terms such as biodegradable, environmentally friendly, natural, oxy-degradable, or soil and marine degradable all tend to confuse consumers. Many of these consumers pay more for the products that they assume are better for the environment based on these terms. They also typically assume that that these products will break down in our composting systems, in the soil and landfills, and even in marine environments, becoming safe. This is not necessarily the case in most instances, and we don't need people throwing these products into our 10,000 lakes thinking they will go away. Mm-hmm. Only those products that meet specific ASTM D6400 or D6868 standards, pass, fail, decomposition standards, within certain time frames and specific environments like composting are actually known to break down properly time and time again. This is because we, as industrial scale composters, can control the process, water, oxygen, and carbon levels to allow microbial populations to reach temperatures in which influence decomposition, unlike other natural environments that will vary significantly across the state and the globe. Greenwashed biodegradable claims, along with standards coming from different countries, are not always equal to the accepted ASTM standards locally. This bill only wants to delay using other claims of degradability for other terms until there is a proven ASTM industrial standard acceptable by all interested parties. Composters in Minnesota have refused to accept European standards for one reason or another, so if they are allowed to be sold here in Minnesota under these labels, many of us will not accept them in our operations, and they will end up in a landfill. The ASTM 6400 compostability standards should currently be the only thing used to determine if products break down properly in specific compost systems, and no harmful residuals are left behind. Contamination from imposters and other forms not seen easily by the naked eye are by far the biggest issues we as composters face each day, and can cost us an upwards of $60,000 to $250,000 at our facilities per year. I can guarantee that without efforts to adjust the current language and make these bio-based compostable products easily identifiable, composters will soon be forced to refuse legitimate compostable products due to the significant contamination that often accompanies them. Lookalike products entering our sites tend to be as much as 30% of the food service where we see, and these products also increase the chance of specific contamination like PFAS and microplastics to get into our systems. It is essential to properly identify these terms as compostable, because that term is clear and concise, in its end system of disposal, unlike marine or soil degradable. Eventually, the beneficial products we create tend to reduce fertilizer or pesticide use while significantly increasing soil's water-holding capabilities, plant growth, and aid in carbon capture. They are used in organic farming, stormwater management, erosion control, home gardening, on sports fields, and in landscaping projects across the state, just to name a few. I urge you all to support this legislation to make sure that consumers and composters know that they are purchasing and receiving products that are truly beneficial to the environment. Removing actual bio-based compostable products from the composting process would directly contradict and inhibit the state from reaching its future diversion and recycling goals. Thank you for your time today, and I'll stick around for any questions as well.
Tony Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record again, Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I'd really like to thank Representative Purcell. I almost made you a senator. I don't know if that's good or bad. Like to thank Representative Purcell for her generous time that she has spent with me and the conversations we've had about House File 1315, Mr. Chairman. But 3 points to be made, Mr. Chairman. In the regards to biodegradable and compostable labeling, there are 4 other states that have worked in this space, New York, Washington, Maryland, California, and they've all referenced what you've heard briefly discussed here today as the European standard, better known as VINCOT or TUV Austria. Also, Washington and Maryland have referenced the FTC Green Guides, and the U.S. Composting Council also points as a good direction for manufacturers and labeling to use the FTC Green Guide. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that would be some good additions when we talk about the ASTM standards to go through to provide folks some direction on the labeling for biodegradable and compostable. Mr. Chairman, if you meet those standards that are enforced by the Pollution Control Agency and also the Attorney General, who may come in and also talk about a covered product and some of the information they would like, it just seems to me, Mr. Chairman, just that it would be duplicative of having to go through and be certified. If you meet all the standards up in the 2.1 to 2.8, and they're enforced by the Pollution Control Agency and the Attorney General, that should be sufficient, I think, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, I think an addition of an education component would be important. I think we know what we're talking about in a retail setting that's actually labeled and on the shelf. But, Mr. Chairman, I think in this space where education would be beneficial and a good value would be in the single-use area. I think there's confusion when we talk about cups and lids and straws, and I think either the Pollution Control Agency, Minnesota Wastewise, or county programs, or some combination thereof, Mr. Chairman, I think that education component would be a good part of this program. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the time.
Representative Purcell, the motion was to go to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. I would ask that it comes back here after that. Are you willing to work with the interested parties and agents and legislators on this?
Chair Hansen, I would love to do that. Thank you.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair, and I appreciate that that the bill would be coming back, so I'll just be super brief, giving Representative Purcell ballpark idea. Again, we on this side of the aisle support what you're trying to get at here. And I think, once again, potentially unintended consequences. Specifically, I'm seeing, if I am reading correctly, MPCA can fine these individuals up to $100 for each prepackaged item sold. I'm wondering maybe if I'm getting that wrong, I apologize, but I'm concerned that there may be an impact that could adversely cause those folks in the middle, the little guys, to wind up making a mistake that costs them or negatively affect them. So those are some things that we're going to want to be able to visit with you about. Hopefully that can be part of that ongoing conversation, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Heinzman. There is some language already in existing law about there being a fee, although it's never been assessed to anyone. So I hear you, and I understand that, and would be happy to continue to work to make sure, looking at where that buck stops on the accountability.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Purcell, would you like to close?
I want to thank my testifiers. I want to thank folks for the great ongoing conversation. I've learned a lot and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Representative Purcell renews her motion that House File 1315 as be amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Members, I apologize for running over a little bit there, and Mr. Diamond, I know you wanted to speak, but if you would have written testimony, we can put that into the record. We are adjourned.